I'm nothing to you. I'll never trouble you again. I'm only a wolf. I lifted my muzzle to the sky and howled. My own howling woke me. I rolled to my hands and knees, shook myself all over, and then came to my feet. A dream, I told myself, only a dream. Fear and shame washed over me, dirtying me in their passage. In my dream I had pleaded for mercy, as I had not in reality. I told myself I was no craven. Was I? It seemed I could still smell and taste the blood. "Where are you going?" Night Eyes asked lazily. He lay deeper in the shade, and his coat camouflaged him surprisingly well there. Water. I went to the stream, splashed sticky rabbit blood from my face and hands, and then drank deeply. I washed my face again, dragging my nails through my beard to get the blood out. Abruptly, I decided I couldn't stand the beard. I didn't intend to go where I expected to be recognized anyway. I went back to the shepherd's hut to slave. At the door, I wrinkled my nose at the musty smell. Night Eyes was right. Sleeping inside had dampened my sense of smell. I could hardly believe I had abided in here. I padded in reluctantly, snorting out the man smells. It had rained a few nights ago. Damp had got into my dried meat and soured some of it. I sorted it out, wrinkling my nose at how far gone it was. Maggots were working in some of it. As I checked the rest of my meat supply carefully, I pushed aside a nagging sense of uneasiness. It was not until I took out the knife and had to clean a fine dusting of rust from it that I admitted it to myself. It had been days since I had been here. Probably weeks. I had no idea of time's passage. I looked at the spoiled meat, at the dust that overlaid my scattered possessions. I felt my beard, shocked at how much it had grown. Burrich and Shade had not left me here days ago. It had been weeks. I went to the door of the hut and looked out. Grass stood tall, where there had been pathways across the meadow to the stream in Burrich's fishing spot. The spring flowers were long gone, the berries green on the bushes. I looked at my hands, at dirt ingrained in the skin of my wrists, old blood caked and dried under my nails. At one time, eating raw flesh would have disgusted me. Now, the notion of cooking meat seemed peculiar and foreign. My mind veered away, and I did not want to confront myself. Later, I heard myself pleading, "Tomorrow, later. Go find Night Eyes."
"You are troubled, little brother."
"Yes." I forced myself to add, "You cannot help me with this. It is man-trouble, a thing I must solve for myself."
"Be a wolf instead,"
he advised lazily. I did not have the strength to say either yes or no to that. I let it go by me. I looked down at myself, at my stained shirt and trousers. My clothing was caked with dirt and old blood, and my trousers tattered off into rags below my knees. With a shudder, I recalled the forged ones and their ragged garments. What had I become? I tugged at the collar of my shirt and then averted my face from my own stink. Wolves were cleaner than this. Night Eyes groomed himself daily. I spoke it aloud, and the rustiness of my voice only added to it.
As soon as Burrich left me here alone, I reverted to something less than an animal. No time, no cleanliness, no goals, no awareness of anything save eating and sleeping. This was what he was trying to warn me about all those years. I did just what he had always feared I would do.
Laboriously, I kindled a fire in the hearth. I hauled water from the stream in many trips and heated as much as I could. The shepherds had left a heavy rendering kettle in the hut, and this held enough to half-fill a wooden trough outside. While the water heated, I gathered soapwort with horsetail grass. I could not remember that I had ever been this dirty. The coarse horsetail grass scrubbed off layers of skin with the grime before I was satisfied I was clean. There were more than a few fleas floating in the water. I also discovered a tick on the back of my neck and burned it off with an ember twig from my fire. When my hair was clean, I combed it out, and then bound it back once more in a warrior's tail. I shaved in the glass Burritch had left me, and then stared at the face there. Tanned brow and pale chin. By the time I had heated more water and soaked and pounded my clothes clean, I was starting to understand Burritch's fanatical and constant cleanliness. The only way to save what was left of my trousers would be to hem them up at the knee. Even then, there was not much wear left in them. I extended my spree to my bedding and winter clothing as well, washing the musty smell out of them. I discovered that a mouse had borrowed from my winter cloak to make a nest. That, too, I mended as well as I could. I looked up from draping wet leggings on a bush to find Night Eyes watching me.
"You smell like a man again."
"Is that good or bad?"
"Better than smelling like last week's kill. Not so good as smelling like a wolf."
He stood and stretched, bowing low to me and spreading his toes wide against the earth.
"So, you do wish to be a man after all. Do we travel soon?"
"Yes. We travel west, up the Buck River."
"Oh."
He sneezed suddenly, then abruptly fell over on his side to roll about on his back in the dust like a puppy. He wiggled happily, working it well into his coat, and then came to his feet to shake it all out again. His blithe acceptance of my sudden decision was a burden. What was I talking him into? Nightfall found me with every garment I owned and all my bedding still damp. I had sent Night Eyes hunting alone. I knew he would not soon return. The moon was full, and the night sky clear. Plenty of game would be moving about tonight. I went inside the hut and built up the fire enough to make hearth cakes from the last of the meal. Weevils had got into the flour and spoiled it. Better to eat the meal now than to waste it similarly. The simple cakes with the last of the grainy honey from the pot tasted incredibly good. I knew I had best expand my diet to include more than meat and a handful of greens each day. I made an odd tea from the wild mint and the tips of the new nettle growth, and that, too, tasted good. I brought in an almost dry blanket and spread it out before the hearth. I lay on it, drowsing and staring into the fire. I quested for Night Eyes, but he disdained to join me, preferring his fresh kill and the soft earth under an oak at the edge of the meadow.
I was alone. And as human as I had been in months. It felt a little strange, but good. It was when I rolled over and stretched that I saw the packet left on the chair. I knew every item in the hut by heart. This had not been here when last I was. I picked it up and snuffed at it, and found Burritch's scent faintly upon it, and my own.
A moment later I realized what I had done and rebuked myself for it. I had best start behaving as if there were always witnesses to my actions, unless I wished to be killed as a witted one again. It was not a large bundle. It was one of my shirts, somehow taken from my old clothes chest, a soft brown one I'd always favored, and a pair of leggings. Bundled up inside the shirt was a small earthenware pot of Burritch's unguent that he used for cuts, burns, and bruises. 4 silver bits in a little leather pouch. He'd worked a buck in the stitching on the front. A good leather belt. I sat staring at the design he'd worked into that.
There was a buck. Antlers lowered to fight, similar to the crest Verity had suggested for me.
On the belt, it was fending off a wolf. Difficult to miss that message. I dressed before the fire, feeling wistful that I had missed his visit, and yet relieved that I had. Knowing Burritch, he'd probably felt much the same at hiking up here, and then finding me gone. Had he brought me these presentable clothes because he wanted to persuade me to return with him, or to wish me well on my way? I tried not to wonder what his intent had been, or his reaction to the abandoned hut. Clothed again, I felt much more human. I hung the pouch and my sheath-knife from the belt and cinched it around my waist. I pulled a chair up before the fire and sat in it. I stared into the fire. I finally allowed myself to think about my dream. I felt a strange tightening in my chest. Was I a coward? I was not sure. I was going to Tradeford to kill Regal. Would a coward do that? Perhaps, my traitor mind told me, perhaps a coward would, if it was easier than seeking out one's king. I pushed that thought from my mind. It came right back. Was going to kill Regal the right thing to do, or merely what I wished to do? Why should that matter? Because it did. Maybe I should be going to find Verity instead. Silly to think about any of it. Until I knew if Verity was still alive, if I could skill to Verity, I could find out. But I'd never been able to skill predictably. Galen had seen to that, with the abuse that had taken my strong natural talent for skill and turned it into a fickle and frustrating thing. Could that be changed? I'd need to be able to skill well. If I wanted to get past the coterie to Regal's throat, I'd have to learn to control it. Was the skill something one could teach oneself to master? How could one learn a thing if one did not even know the full scope of it? All of the ability that Galen had neither beaten into nor out of me, all the knowledge that Verity had never had time to teach me, how was I to learn all that on my own? It was impossible. I did not want to think of Verity. That, as much as anything, told me that I should. Verity, my prince, my king now, linked by blood and the skill. I had grown to know him as I knew no other man. Being open to the skill, he had told me, was as simple as not being closed to it. His skill warring with the raiders had become his life, draining away his youth and vitality. He had never had the time to teach me to control my talent, but he had given me what lessons he could in the infrequent chances he had. His skill strength was such that he could impose a touch on me, and be one with me for days, sometimes weeks. And once, when I had sat in my prince's chair in his study before his work table, I had skilled to him. Before me had been the tools of his map-making and the small personal clutter of the man who waited to be king. That one time I had thought of him, longed for him to be home to guide his kingdom, and had simply reached out and skilled to him. So easily, without preparation or even real intent. I tried to put myself in that same frame of mind. I had not Verity's desk nor clutter to put him in mind, but if I closed my eyes, I could see my prince. I took a breath and tried to call forth his image. Verity was broader of shoulder than I, but not quite of my height. My uncle shared with me the dark eyes and hair of the Farseer family, but his eyes were set more deeply than mine, and his unruly hair and beard were shot through with grey. When I was a boy, he had been well-muscled and hard. A stocky man who wielded a sword as easily as a pen. These later years had wasted him. He had been forced to spend too much time physically idle, as he used his skill strength to defend our coastline from the raiders. But even as his muscle had dwindled, his skill aura had increased, until to stand before him now was like standing before a blazing hearth. When I was in his presence, I was much more aware of his skill now than his body. For his scent, I called to mind the piquancy of the coloured inks he used when he made his maps, the smell of fine vellum, and, too, the edge of elf bark that was often on his breath. Verity, I said softly aloud, and felt the word echo within me, bouncing off my walls. I opened my eyes.
I could not reach out of myself until I lowered my walls. Visualizing Verity would do nothing for me until I opened a way for my skill to go forth, and his to enter my mind. Very well. That was easy enough. Just relax, stare into the fire, and watch the tiny sparks that rode upward on the heat. Dancing, floating sparks. Relax the vigilance. Forget how Will had slammed his skill strength against that wall and nearly made it give way. Forget that holding the wall was all that kept my mind my own while they hammered away at my flesh. Forget that sickening sense of violation, the time that Justin had forced his way into me. The way Galen had scarred and crippled my skill ability, the time he had abused his position as skill master to force his control on my mind. As clearly as if Verity were beside me, I heard again my prince's words. Galen has scarred you. Your walls I can't begin to penetrate, and I am strong. You'd have to learn to drop them. That's a hard thing. And those words to me had been years ago, before Justin's invasion, before Will's attacks. I smiled bitterly. Did they know they had succeeded at unskilling me? They'd probably never even given it thought. Someone, somewhere, should make a record of that. Some day a skilled king might find it handy to know that if you hurt a skilled one badly enough with the skill, you could seal him up inside himself and render him powerless in that area. Verity had never had the time to teach me how to drop those walls. Ironically, he had found a way to show me how to reinforce them so I could seal my private thoughts from him when I did not wish to share them. Perhaps that was a thing I had learned too well. I wondered if I would ever have time to unlearn it. Time, no time. Night Eyes interrupted wearily. Time is a thing that men made up to bother themselves with. You think on it until I am dizzy. Why do you follow these old trails at all? Snuff out a new one that may have some meat at the end of it. If you want the game, you must stalk it, that is all. You cannot say, to stalk this takes too long, I wish to simply eat. It is all one. The stalking is the beginning of the eating. You do not understand, I told him wearily. There are only so many hours in a day and only so many days in which I can do this thing. Why do you chop your life into bits and give the bits names, hours, days? It is like a rabbit. If I kill a rabbit, I eat a rabbit. A sleepy sort of disdain. When you have a rabbit, you chop it up and call it bones and meat and fur and guts, and so you never have enough. So what should I do, O wise master? Stop whining about it and just do it. So I can sleep. He gave me a slight mind nudge, like an elbow in the ribs when a companion crowds too close to you on the tavern bench. I suddenly realized how closely I'd been holding our contact these past few weeks. Had been a time when I had rebuked him for always being in my mind. I had not wanted his company when I was with Molly, and I had tried to explain to him then that such times must belong to me alone. Now his nudge made it plain to me that I had been clinging as close to him as he had to me when he was a cub. I firmly resisted my first impulse to clutch at him. Instead, I settled back in my chair and looked at the fire. I took the walls down. I sat for a time with my mouth dry, waiting for an attack. When nothing came, I thought carefully, and again lowered my walls. They believe me dead, I reminded myself. They will not be lying in wait to ambush a dead man. It was still not easy to will my walls down. Far easier to unsquint my eyes on a day of bright sunlight, on the water, or to stand unflinching before a coming blow. But when finally I did it, I could sense the skill flowing all about me, parting around me as if I were a stone in the current of a river. I had but to plunge into it, and I could find Verity, or Will, or Burl, or Carid.
I shuddered, and the river retreated. I steeled myself and returned to it. A long time I stood teetering on that bank, daring myself to plunge in. No such thing as testing the water with the skill. In or out? In. In. And I was spinning and tumbling, and I felt myself fraying apart like a piece of rotten hemp rope. Strands peeling and twisting away from me. All the overlays that made me myself. Memories, emotions, the deep thoughts that mattered. The flashes of poetry that one experiences that strike deeper than understanding. The random memories of ordinary days, all of it tattering away. It felt so good. All I had to do was let go. But that would have made Galen right about me. Verity? There was no reply. Nothing. He wasn't there. I drew back into myself and pulled my entire self about my mind. I could do it, I found. I could hold myself in the skill stream and yet maintain my identity. Why had it always been so hard before? I set that question aside and considered the worst. The worst was that Verity had been alive and spoken to me a few short months ago. Tell them Verity's alive. That's all. And I had, but they had not understood, and no one had taken any action. Yet, what could that message have been if not a plea for help? A call for help from my king had gone unanswered. Suddenly. That was not a thing to be borne, and the skill cry that went out from me was something I felt, as if my very life sprang out of my chest in a questing reach. Verity! Chivalry? No more than a whisper brushing against my consciousness, as slight as a moth battering at a window curtain. It was my turn this time, to reach and grasp and steady. I flung myself out toward him and found him. His presence flickered like a candle flame gutting out in the pool of its own wax. I knew he would soon be gone. I had 1,000 questions. I asked the only important one. Verity, can you take strength from me without touching me?
Fitz.
The question, more feeble, more hesitant.
I thought chivalry had come back.
He teetered on the edge of darkness.
To take this burden from me.
Verity, pay attention, think. Can you take strength from me? Can you do it now?
I don't... I can't... reach. Fitz.
I remembered Shrewd, drawing strength from me to skill a farewell to his son, and how Justin and Serene had attacked him and leached all his strength away and killed him. How he had died. Like a bubble popping, like a spark, winking out. Verity! I flung myself at him, wrapped myself around him, steadied him, as he had so often steadied me in our skill contacts. Take from me! I commanded him, and opened myself to him. I willed myself to believe in the reality of his hand on my shoulder, tried to recall what it had felt like the times when he or Shrewd had drawn strength from me. The flame that was Verity leaped up suddenly, and after a moment burned strong and clean again. Enough, he cautioned me. Then more strongly,
be careful, boy.
No, I'm all right, I can do this, I assured him, and willed my strength to him.
Enough,
he insisted, and drew back from me. It was almost as if we stepped slightly apart and considered one another. I could not see his body, but I could sense the terrible weariness in him. It was not the healthy weariness that comes at the end of a day's labour, but the bone weariness of one grinding day, piled upon another, with never food enough nor rest enough in between them. I had given him strength, but not health, and he would quickly burn the vitality he had borrowed from me. For it was not true strength, any more than elf bark tea was a sustaining meal.
Where are you?
I demanded of him.
In the mountains,
he said unwillingly, and added,
it is not safe to say more. We should not skill at all. There are those who would try to hear us.
But he did not end the contact, and I knew he was as hungry to ask questions as I was. I tried to think what I could tell him. I could sense no one save ourselves, but I was not certain I would know if we were spied upon. For long moments our contact held simply, as an awareness of one another. Then Verity warned me sternly, "You must be more careful. You will draw down trouble on yourself. Yet I take heart from this. I have gone long without the touch of a friend. Then it is worth any risk to myself." I hesitated, then found I could not confine the thought within myself. "My king, there is something I must do, but when it is done, I will come to you." I sensed something from him then, a gratitude humbling in its intensity. "I hope I shall still be here if you arrive." Then more sternly, "Speak no names, skill only if you must." More softly then, "Be careful of yourself, boy. Be very careful. They are ruthless." And then he was gone. He had broken the skill contact off cleanly. I hoped that wherever he was, he would use the strength I had loaned him to find some food or a safe place to rest. I had sensed him living as a hunted thing, always wary, ever hungry. Prey, much as I was. And something else. An injury, a fever. I leaned back in my chair, trembling lightly. I knew better than to try to stand. Simply skilling took strength out of me, and I had opened myself to Verity and let him draw off even more. In a few moments, when the shaking lessened, I would make some elf-bark tea and restore myself. For now, I sat and stared into the fire and thought of Verity. Verity had left Buckkeep last autumn. It seemed like an eternity ago. When Verity had departed, King Shrewd had lived yet, and Verity's wife Ketrickin had been pregnant. He had set himself a quest. The Red Ship raiders from the Out Islands had assailed our shores for 3 full years, and all our efforts to drive them away had failed. So Verity, king-in-waiting for the throne of the 6 duchies, had set out to go to the mountains, there to find our near-legendary allies, the Elderlings. Tradition had it that generations ago, King Wisdom had sought them out, and they had aided the 6 duchies against similar raiders. They had also promised to return, if ever we needed them. And so, Verity had left the throne, and wife, and kingdom, behind, to seek them out and remind them of their promise. His aged father, King Shrewd, had remained behind, and also his younger brother, Prince Regal. Almost the moment Verity was gone, Regal began to move against him. He courted the inland dukes and ignored the needs of the coastal duchies. I suspected he was the source of the widespread rumors that made mock of Verity's quest and painted him as an irresponsible fool, if not a madman. The coterie of skill users who should have been sworn to Verity had long been corrupted to Regal's service. He used them to announce that Verity had died while en route to the mountains, and then proclaimed himself king-in-waiting. His control over the ailing King Shrewd became absolute. Regal had declared he would move his court inland, abandoning Buckkeep in every way that mattered, to the mercies of the Red Ships. When he announced that King Shrewd and Verity's Queen Ketrickin must go with him, Chade had decided we must act. We knew Regal would suffer neither of them to stand between him and the throne. So we had made our plans to spirit them both away on the very evening he declared himself king-in-waiting. Nothing went as planned. The coastal dukes had been close to rising up against Regal. They had tried to recruit me to their rebellion. I had agreed to aid their cause, in the hope of keeping Buckkeep as a position of power for Verity. Before we could spirit the king away, 2 coterie members had killed him. Only Ketrickin had fled, and although I had killed those who had killed King Shrewd, I myself was captured, tortured, and found guilty of the wit magic. Lady Patience, my father's wife, had interceded on my behalf, to no avail.
Had Burich not managed to smuggle poison to me, I would have been hung over water and burned. But the poison had been enough to counterfeit death convincingly. While my soul rode with night eyes in his body, Patience had claimed my body from the prison cell and buried it. Unbeknownst to her, Burich and Chade had disinterred me as soon as they safely could. I blinked my eyes and looked away from the flames. The fire had burned low. My life was like that now, all in ashes behind me. There was no way to reclaim the woman I had loved. Molly believed me dead now, and doubtless viewed my use of wit magic with disgust, and anyway she left me days before the rest of my life had fallen apart. I had known her since we were children, and had played together on the streets and docks of Buckkeep Town. She had called me New Boy, and I assumed I was just one of the children from the keep, a stable boy, or a scribe's lad. She had fallen in love with me before she discovered I was the bastard, the illegitimate son that had forced chivalry to abdicate the throne. When she found out, I very nearly lost her, but I had persuaded her to trust me, to believe in me, and for almost a year we had clung to one another, despite every obstacle. Time and again, I had been forced to put my duty to the king ahead of what we wished to do. The king had refused me permission to marry. She had accepted that. He had pledged me to another woman, even that she had tolerated. She had been threatened and mocked as the bastard's whore. I had been unable to protect her, but she had been so steadfast through it all, until one day she simply told me there was someone else for her, someone she could love, and put above all else in her life, just as I did my king. And she had left me. I could not blame her. I could only miss her. I closed my eyes. I was tired, nearly exhausted, and Verity had warned me to skill no more, unless I must. But surely it could not hurt to attempt a glimpse of Molly, just to see her for a moment, to see that she was well. I probably wouldn't even succeed at seeing her. But what could I hurt by trying, just for a moment? It should have been easy. It was effortless to recall everything about her. I had so often breathed her scent, compounded of the herbs she used to scent her candles, and the warmth of her own sweet skin. I knew every nuance of her voice, and how it went deeper when she laughed. I could recall the precise line of her jaw, and how she set her chin when she was annoyed with me. I knew the glossy texture of her rich, brown hair, and the darting glance of her dark eyes. She had had a way of putting her hands to the sides of my face and holding me firmly. While she kissed me, I lifted my own hand to my face, wishing I could find her hand there, that I could trap it and hold it forever. Instead, I found the seam of a scar. The foolish tears rose warm in my eyes. I blinked them away, seeing the flames of my fire swim for a moment before my vision steadied. I was tired, I told myself, too tired to try and find Molly with my skill. I should try to get some sleep. I tried to set myself apart from these two human emotions, yet this was what I chose when I chose to be a man again. Maybe it was wiser to be a wolf. Surely an animal never had to feel these things. Out in the night, a single wolf lifted his nose and howled suddenly up to the sky, piercing the night with his loneliness and despair.
4. The River Road. Buck, the oldest duchy of the 6 duchies, has a coastline that stretches from just below the High Downs southward to include the mouth of the Buck River and the Bay of Buck. Antler Island is included in the Duchy of Buck. Buck's wealth has 2 major sources, the rich fishing grounds that the coastal folk have always enjoyed, and the shipping trade, created by supplying the inland duchies with all they lack, via the Buck River. The Buck River is a wide river, meandering freely in its bed and often flooding the lowlands of Buck during the spring. The current is such that an ice-free channel has always remained open in the river, year-round, save for the four severest winters in Buck's history. Not only Buck goods travel up the river to the inland duchies, but trade goods from Ripon and Shoke's duchies, not to mention the more exotic items from the Chalcid states and those of the Bingtown traders. Down the river comes all that the inland duchies have to offer, as well as the fine furs and ambers from the Mountain Kingdom trade. I awoke when Night Eyes nudged my cheek with a cold nose. Even then I did not startle awake, but became suddenly aware of my surroundings. My head pounded and my face felt stiff. The empty bottle from the elderberry wine rolled away from me as I pushed myself to a sitting position on the floor.
You sleep too soundly. Are you sick?
No. Just stupid.
I never before noticed that it made you sleep soundly.
He poked me with his nose again, and I pushed him away. I squeezed my eyes shut for a moment, then opened them again. Nothing had improved. I tossed a few more sticks of wood onto the embers of last night's fire.
"Is it morning?"
I asked sleepily, aloud.
"The light is just starting to change. We should go back to the rabbit warren place."
"You go ahead. I'm not hungry."
"Very well."
He started off, then paused in the open doorway.
"I do not think that sleeping inside is good for you."
Then he was gone, a shifting of greyness from the threshold. Slowly, I lay down again and closed my eyes.
I would sleep for just a short time longer.
When I awoke again, full daylight was streaming in the open door. A brief wit-quest found a satiated wolf drowsing in the dappling sunlight between two big roots of an oak tree. Night Eyes had small use for bright sunny days. Today I agreed with him, but forced myself back to yesterday's resolution. I began to set the hut to rights. Then it occurred to me that I would probably never see this place again. Habit made me finish sweeping it out anyway. I cleared the ashes from the hearth and set a fresh armload of wood there. If anyone did pass this way and need shelter, they would find all ready for them. I gathered up my now dry clothing and set everything I would be taking with me on the table. It was pathetically little if one was thinking of it as all I had. When I considered that I had to carry all of it on my own back, it seemed plentiful. I went down to the stream to drink and wash before trying to make it into a manageable pack. As I walked back from the stream, I was wondering how disgruntled Night Eyes was going to be about traveling by day. I had dropped my extra leggings on the doorstep somehow. I stooped and picked them up as I entered, tossing them onto the table. I suddenly realized I wasn't alone. The garment on the doorstep should have warned me. But I had become careless. It had been too long since I had been threatened. I had begun to rely completely on my wit sense to let me know when others were around. Forged ones could not be perceived that way. Neither the wit nor the skill would avail me anything against them. There were two of them, both young men, and not long forged by the look of them. Their clothing was mostly intact. And while they were dirty, it was not the ground-in filth and matted hair that I had come to associate with the forged. Most of the times I had fought forged ones, it had been winter, and they had been weakened by privation. One of my duties as King Shrewd's assassin had been to keep the area around Buck Keep free of them. We had never discovered what magic the Red Ships used on our folk to snatch them from their families and return them, but hours later, as emotionless brutes. We knew only that the sole cure was a merciful death. The forged ones were the worst of the horrors that the raiders loosed on us. They left our own kin to prey on us, long after their ships were gone. Which was worse? To face your brother, knowing that theft, murder, and rape were perfectly acceptable to him now, as long as he got what he wished? Or take up your knife and go out to hunt him down, and kill him? I had interrupted the two as they were pawing through my possessions, hands full of dried meat. They were feeding, each keeping a wary eye on the other. Though forged ones might travel together, they had absolutely no loyalty to anyone. Perhaps the company of other humans was merely a habit. I had seen them turn savagely upon one another to dispute ownership of some plunder, or merely when they had become hungry enough. But now they swung their gazes to me, considering. I froze where I was. For a moment, no one moved. They had the food and all my possessions. There was no reason for them to attack me, as long as I didn't challenge them. I eased back toward the door, stepping slowly and carefully, keeping my hands down and still, just as if I'd come up on a bear on its kill, so I did not look directly at them as I gingerly eased back from their territory. I was nearly clear of the door when one lifted a dirty hand to point at me.
"Dreams too loud,"
he declared angrily. They both dropped their plunder and sprang after me. I whirled and fled, smashing solidly chest to chest with one who was just coming in the door. He was wearing my extra shirt and little else, his arms closed around me almost reflexively. I did not hesitate. I could reach my belt knife and did, and punched it into his belly a couple of times before he fell back from me. He curled over with a roar of pain as I shoved past him.
"Brother!"
I sensed, and knew Night Eyes was coming, but he was too far away, up on the ridge. A man hit me solidly from behind, and I went down. I rolled in his grip, screaming in hoarse terror as he suddenly awakened in me every searing memory of Regal's dungeon. Panic came over me like a sudden poison. I plunged back into nightmare. I was too terrified to move. My heart hammered. I could not take a breath. My hands were numb. I could not tell if I still gripped my knife. His hand touched my throat. Frantically, I flailed at him, thinking only of escape, of evading that touch. His companion saved me with a savage kick that grazed my side as I thrashed and connected solidly with the ribs of the man on top of me. I heard him gasp out his air, and with a wild shove, I had him off me. I rolled clear, came to my feet, and fled. I ran, powered by fear so intense I could not think. I heard one man close behind me, and thought I could hear the other behind him. But I knew these hills and pastures now as my wolf knew them. I took them up the steep hill, behind the cottage, and before they could crest it, I changed direction and went to earth. An oak had fallen during the last of the winter's wild storms, rearing up a great wall of earth with its tangled roots, and taking lesser trees down with it. It had made a fine tangle of trunks and branches, and let a wide slice of sunlight into the forest. The blackberries had sprung up, rejoicing, and overwhelmed the fallen giant. I flung myself to the earth beside it. I squirmed on my belly through the thorniest part of the blackberry canes, into the darkness beneath the oak's trunk. And then lay completely still. I heard their angry shouting as they searched for me. In a panic, I threw up my mental walls as well. Dreams too loud. The forged one had accused me. Well, Chade and Verity had both suspected that skilling drew the forged ones. Perhaps the keenness of feeling it demanded, and the outreaching of that feeling in skill, touched something in them and reminded them of all they had lost, and made them want to kill whomever could still feel?
Maybe. "Brother?"
It was Night Eyes, muted somehow, or at a very great distance. I dared open to him a bit.
I'm all right.
Where are you?
Right here.
I heard a rustling, and suddenly he was there, bellying through to me. He touched his nose to my cheek.
Are you hurt?
No. I ran away.
Wise,
he observed, and I could sense that he meant it. But I could sense, too, that he was surprised. He had never seen me flee from forged ones. Always before I had stood and fought, and he had stood and fought beside me. Well, those times I had usually been well-armed and well-fed, and they had been starved and suffering from the cold. 3 against 1 when you've only a belt-knife as a weapon are bad odds, even if you know a wolf is coming to help you. There was nothing of cowardice in it. Any man would have done so. I repeated the thought several times to myself.
It's all right,
he soothed me. Then he added,
don't you want to come out?
In a while,
when they've gone.
I hushed him.
They've been gone a long time now,
he offered me.
They left while the sun was still high.
I just want to be sure.
I am sure. I watched them go. I followed them. Come out, little brother.
I let him coax me out of the brambles. I found when I emerged that the sun was almost setting. How many hours had I spent there? Senses deadened, like a snail pulled into its shell. I brushed dirt from the front of my formerly clean clothes. There was blood there as well, the blood of the young man in the doorway. I'd have to wash my clothes again, I thought dumbly. For a moment, I thought of hauling the water and heating it, of scrubbing out the blood. And then I knew I could not go into the hut and be trapped in there again. Yet, the few possessions I had were there, or whatever the forged ones had left of them. By moonrise, I had found the courage to approach the hut. It was a good full moon, lighting up the wide meadow before the hut. For some time I crouched on the ridge, peering down and watching for any shadows that might move. One man was lying in the deep grass near the door of the hut. I stared at him for a long time, looking for movement.
He's dead. Use your nose,
Night Eyes recommended. That would be the one I had met coming out the door. My knife must have found something vital. He had not gone far. Still, I stalked him through the darkness as carefully as if he were a wounded bear. But soon I smelled the sweetish stench of something dead left all day in the sun. He was sprawled face down in the grass. I did not turn him over, but made a wide circle around him. I peered through the window of the hut, studying the still darkness of the interior for some minutes.
There's no one in there,
Night Eyes reminded me impatiently. You are sure?
As sure as I am that I have a wolf's nose and not a useless lump of flesh beneath my eyes. My brother!
He let the thought trail off, but I could feel his wordless anxiety for me. I almost shared it. A part of me knew there was little to fear that the forged ones had taken whatever they wanted and moved on. Another part could not forget the weight of the man upon me, and the brushing force of that kick. I had been pinned like that against the stone floor of a dungeon and pounded, fist and boot, and I had not been able to do anything. Now that I had that memory back, I wondered how I would live with it. I did finally go into the hut. I even forced myself to kindle a light once my groping hands had found my flint. My hands shook as I hastily gathered what they had left me and bundled it into my cloak. The open door behind me was a threatening black gap through which they might come at any moment, yet if I closed it, I might be trapped inside. Not even Night Eyes, keeping watch on the doorstep, could reassure me. They had taken only what they had immediate use for. Forged ones did not plan beyond each moment. All the dried meat had been eaten or flung aside. I wanted none of what they had touched.
They had opened my scribe's case, but lost interest when they found nothing to eat in there. The smaller box of poisons and herbs they had probably assumed held my scribe's colour pots. It had not been tampered with. Of my clothes, only the one shirt had been taken, and I had no interest in reclaiming it. I'd punched its belly full of holes anyway. I took what was left, and departed. I crossed the meadow and climbed to the top of the ridge, where I had a good view in all directions. There I sat down, and with trembling hands packed what I had left for travelling. I used my winter cloak to wrap it, and tied the bundle tightly with leather thongs. A separate strapping allowed me to sling it over a shoulder. When I had more light, I could devise a better way to carry it. "Ready?" I asked Night Eyes.
"Do we hunt now?"
"No, we travel." I hesitated. "Are you very hungry?"
"A bit. Are you in so much of a hurry to be away from here?"
I didn't need to think about that. "Yes, I am."
"Then do not be concerned. We can both travel and hunt."
I nodded, then glanced up at the night sky. I found the tiller in the night sky and took a bearing off it. "That way," I said, pointing down the far side of the ridge. The wolf made no reply, but simply rose and trotted purposefully off in the direction I pointed. I followed, ears pricked and all senses keen for anything that might move in the night. I moved quietly, and nothing followed us. Nothing followed me at all, save my fear. The night travelling became our pattern. I had planned to travel by day and sleep by night. But after that first night of trotting through the woods behind Night Eyes, following whichever game trails led in a generally correct direction, I decided it was better. I could not have slept by night anyway. For the first few days I even had trouble sleeping by day. I would find a vantage point that still offered us concealment and lie down, certain of my exhaustion. I would curl up and close my eyes and then lie there, tormented by the keenness of my own senses. Every sound, every scent would jolt me back to alertness, and I could not relax again until I had arisen to assure myself there was no danger. After a time, even Night Eyes complained of my restlessness. When finally I did fall asleep, it was only to shudder awake at intervals, sweating and shaking. Lack of sleep by day made me miserable by night as I trotted along in Night Eyes' wake. Yet, those sleepless hours and the hours when I trotted after Night Eyes, head pounding with pain, those were not wasted hours. In those hours I nurtured my hatred of Regal and his coterie. I honed it to a fine edge. This was what he had made of me. Not enough that he had taken from me my life, my lover. Not enough that I must avoid the people and places I cared about. Not enough the scars I bore and the random tremblings that overtook me. No. He had made me this shaking, frightened rabbit of a man. I had not even the courage to recall all he had done to me, yet I knew that when push came to shove, those memories would rise up and reveal themselves to unman me. Memories I could not summon by day, lurked as fragments of sound and colours and textures that tormented me by night. The sensation of my cheek against cold stone, slick with a thin layer of my warm blood. The flash of light that accompanied a man's fist striking the side of my head. The guttural sounds men make, the hooting and grunting that issue from them as they watch someone being beaten. Those were the jagged edges that sliced through my efforts at sleep. Sandy-eyed and trembling, I would lie awake beside the wolf and think of Regal. Once I had had a love that I believed would carry me through anything. Regal had taken that from me. Now I nurtured a hatred fully as strong. We hunted as we travelled. My resolution to always cook the meat soon proved futile. I managed a fire perhaps one night out of three, and only if I could find a hollow tree where it would not attract attention. I did not, however, allow myself to sink down to being less than a beast. I kept myself clean and took as much care with my clothing as our rough life allowed me. My plan for our journey was a simple one. We would travel cross-country until we struck the Buck River. The river road paralleled it up to Ter Lake. A lot of people traveled that road. It might be difficult for the wolf to remain unseen, but it was the swiftest way. Once there, it was but a short distance to Tradeford on the Vin River. In Tradeford, I would kill Regal. That was the sum total of my plan. I refused to consider how I would accomplish any of this. I refused to worry about all I did not know. I would simply move forward one day at a time until I had met my goals. That much I had learned from being a wolf. I knew the coast from a summer of manning an oar on Verity's warship, the Rurisk, but I was not personally familiar with the inlands of Buck Duchy. True, I had travelled through it once before, on the way to the mountains for Ketrickan's pledging ceremony. Then I had been part of the wedding caravan, well mounted and well provisioned. But now I travelled alone, and on foot, with time to consider what I saw. We crossed some wild country, but much, too, had once been summer pasturage for flocks of sheep, goats, and cattle. Time after time we traversed meadows chest high in ungrazed grasses to find shepherds' huts, cold and deserted, since last autumn. The flocks we did see were small ones, not nearly the size of flocks I recalled from previous years. I saw few swineherds and goosegirls compared with my first journey through this area. As we drew closer to the Buck River, we passed grain fields substantially smaller than I recalled, with much good land given back to wild grasses, not even ploughed. It made small sense to me. I had seen this happening along the coast, where farmers' flocks and crops had been repeatedly destroyed by the raids. In recent years, whatever did not go to the red ships in fire or plunder was taken by taxes to fund the warships and soldiers that scarcely protected them. But upriver, out of the raiders' reach, I had thought to find Buck more prosperous. It disheartened me. We soon struck the road that followed the Buck River. There was much less traffic than I recalled, both on the road and the river. Those we encountered on the road were brusque and unfriendly, even when Night Eyes was out of sight. I stopped once at a farmstead to ask if I might draw cold water from their well. It was allowed me, but no one called off the snarling dogs as I did so, and when my water skin was full, the woman told me I'd best be on my way. Her attitude seemed to be the prevailing one, and the farther I went, the worse it became. The travellers I encountered on the roads were not merchants with wagons of goods or farmers taking produce to market. Instead, they were ragged families, often with all they possessed in a pushcart or two. The eyes of the adults were hard and unfriendly, while those of the children were often stricken and empty. Any hopes I had had of finding day work along this road were soon surrendered. Those who still possessed homes and farms guarded them jealously. Dogs barked in the yards, and farm workers guarded the young crops from thieves after dark. We passed several beggar towns, clusters of makeshift huts and tents alongside the road. By night, bonfires burned brightly in them, and cold-eyed adults stood guard with staffs and pikes. By day, children sat along the road and begged from passing travellers. I thought I understood why the merchant wagons I did see were so well guarded. We had travelled on the road for several nights, ghosting silently through many small hamlets, before we came to a town of any size. Dawn overtook us as we approached the outskirts. When some early merchants with a cart of caged chickens overtook us, we knew it was time to get out of sight. We settled for the daylight hours on a small rise that let us look down on a town built half out onto the river. When I could not sleep, I sat and watched the commerce on the road below us. Small boats and large were tied at the docks of the town. Occasionally, the wind brought me the shouts of the crews unloading from the ships. Once, I even heard a snatch of song. To my surprise, I found myself drawn to my own kind. I left Night Eyes sleeping, but only went as far as the creek at the foot of the hill. I set myself to washing out my shirt and leggings.
"We should avoid this place. They will try to kill you if you go there,"
Night Eyes offered helpfully. He was sitting on a creek bank beside me, watching me wash myself as evening darkened the sky. My shirt and leggings were almost dry. I had been attempting to explain to him why I wished to have him wait for me while I went into the town, to the inn there. Why would they want to kill me?
"We are strangers coming into their hunting grounds. Why shouldn't they try to kill us?"
"Humans are not like that," I explained patiently.
"No, you are right. They will probably just put you in a cage and beat you."
"No, they won't." I insisted firmly to cover up my own fears that perhaps someone might recognize me.
"They did before," he insisted. "Both of us. And that was your own pack."
I could not deny that. So I promised. "I will be very, very careful. I shall not be long. I just want to go listen to them talk for a bit, to find out what is happening."
"Why should we care what is happening to them? What is happening to us is that we are neither hunting, nor sleeping, nor traveling. They are not pack with us."
"It may tell us what to expect, farther on our journey. I may find out if the roads are heavily traveled, if there is work I can take for a day or so to get a few coins, that sort of thing."
"We could simply travel on and find out for ourselves,"
Night Eyes pointed out stubbornly. I dragged on my shirt and leggings over my damp skin. I combed my hair back with my fingers, squeezed the moisture from it. Habit made me tie it back in a warrior's tail. Then I bit my lip, considering. I had planned to represent myself as a wandering scribe. I took it out of its tail and shook it loose. It came almost to my shoulders. A bit long for a scribe's hair. Most of them kept their hair short and shaved it back from the brow line to keep it from their eyes when they worked. Well, with my untrimmed beard and shaggy hair, perhaps I could be taken for a scribe who had been long without work. Not a good recommendation for my skills, but given the poor supplies I had, perhaps that was best. I tugged my shirt straight to make myself presentable. I fastened my belt, checked to be sure my knife sat securely in its sheath, and then hefted the paltry weight of my purse. The flint in it weighed more than the coins. I did have the 4 silver bits from Burridge. A few months ago it would not have seemed like much money. Now it was all I had, and I resolved not to spend it unless I must. The only other wealth I had was the earring Burridge had given me, and the pin from Shrewd. Reflexively my hand went to the earring. As annoying as it could be when we were hunting through dense brush, the touch of it always reassured me. Likewise the pin in the collar of my shirt. The pin that wasn't there. I took the shirt off and checked the entire collar, and then the complete garment. I methodically kindled a small fire for light, then I undid my bundle completely and went through everything in it, not once, but twice. This, despite my almost certain knowledge of where the pin was. The small red ruby in its nest of silver was in the collar of a shirt worn by a dead man outside the shepherd's hut. I was all but certain, and yet I could not admit it to myself. All the while I searched, Night Eyes prowled in an uncertain circle around my fire, whining in soft agitation about the anxiety he sensed, but could not comprehend.
"Shush!"
I told him irritably, and forced my mind to go back over the events as if I were going to report to Shrewd. The last time I could remember having the pin was the night I had driven Burrich and Chade away. I had taken it out of the shirt's collar and showed it to them both, and then sat looking at it. Then I had put it back. I could not recall handling it since then. I could not recall taking it out of the shirt when I washed it. It seemed I should have jabbed myself with it when I washed it, if it was still there. But I usually pushed the pin into a seam where it would hold tighter. It had seemed safer so. I had no way of knowing if I had lost it hunting with the wolf, or if it was still in the shirt the dead man wore. Perhaps it had been left on the table, and one of the forged ones had picked up the bright thing when they pawed through my possessions. It was just a pin, I reminded myself. With a sick longing I wished I would suddenly see it, caught in the lining of my cloak, or tumbled inside my boot. In a sudden flash of hope, I checked inside both boots again. It still wasn't there. It was just a pin, just a bit of worked metal and a gleaming stone. Just a token King Shrewd had given me when he claimed me. When he created a bond between us to replace the blood one that could never be legitimately recognized. Just a pin. And all I had left of my king and my grandfather. Night Eyes whined again, and I felt an irrational urge to snarl back at him. He must have known that, but still he came, flipping my elbow up with his nose and then burrowing his head under my arm until his great grey head was up against my chest and my arm around his shoulders. He tossed his nose up suddenly, clacking his muzzle painfully against my chin. I hugged him hard, and he turned to rub his throat against my face. The ultimate gesture of trust. Wolf to wolf. That baring of the throat to another's possible snarl. After a moment I sighed, and the pain of loss I felt over the thing was less.
It was just a thing from yesterday?
Night Eyes wondered hesitantly.
A thing no longer here? It is not a thorn in your paw, or a pain in your belly?
Just a thing from yesterday. I had to agree. A pin that had been given to a boy who no longer existed by a man who had died. Perhaps it was as well, I thought to myself. One less thing that might connect me to Fitz Chivalry, the Witted. I ruffled the fur on the back of his neck, then scratched behind his ears. He sat up beside me, then nudged me to get me to rub his ears again. I did, thinking as I did so. Perhaps I should take off Burrich's earring and keep it concealed in my pouch. But I knew I would not. Let it be the one link I carried forward from that life to this one. Let me up, I told the wolf, and he reluctantly stopped leaning on me. Methodically I repacked my possessions into a bundle and fastened it, then trampled out the tiny fire. Shall I come back here or meet you on the other side of town?
Other side?
If you circle about the town and then come back toward the river, you will find more of the road there, I explained. Shall we find one another there?
That would be good. The less time we spend near this den of humans, the better.
Fine, then. I shall find you there before morning, I told him.
Most likely I shall find you, Numb Nose, and I shall have a full belly when I do.
I had to concede that was likelier. Watch out for dogs, I warned him as he faded into the brush.
You watch out for men,
he rejoined, and then was lost to my senses, save for our wit bond. I slung my pack over my shoulder and made my way down the road. It was full dark now. I had intended to reach the town before dark and stop at a tavern for the talk and perhaps a mug, and then be on my way. I had wanted to walk through the market square and listen in on the talk of the merchants. Instead, I walked into a town that was mostly abed. The market was deserted save for a few dogs nosing in the empty stalls for scraps. I left the square and turned my steps toward the river. Down there I would find inns and taverns aplenty to accommodate the river trade. A few torches burned here and there throughout the town, but Most of the light in the streets was what spilled from poorly shuttered windows. The roughly cobbled streets were not well kept up. Several times I mistook a hole for a shadow, and nearly stumbled. I stopped a town watchman before he could stop me, to ask him to recommend a waterfront inn to me. The Scales, he told me, was as fair and honest to travellers as its name implied, and was easily found as well. He warned me sternly that begging was not tolerated there, and that cutpurses would be lucky if a beating was all they got. I thanked him for his warnings, and went on my way. I found the Scales as easily as the watchman had said I would. Light spilled out from its open door, and with it the voices of two women singing a merry round. My heart cheered at the friendly sound of it, and I entered without hesitation. Within the stout walls of mud brick and heavy timbers was a great open room, low-ceilinged and rich with the smells of meat and smoke and river folk. A cooking hearth at one end of the room had a fine spit of meat in its maw. But most folk were gathered at the cooler end of the room on this fine summer evening. There the two minstrels had dragged chairs up on top of a table and were twining their voices together. A grey-haired fellow with a harp, evidently part of their group, was sweating at another table as he fastened a new string to his instrument. I judged them a master and two journey singers, possibly a family group. I stood watching them sing together, and my mind went back to Buck Keep and the last time I had heard music and seen folk gathered together. I did not realize I was staring until I saw one of the women surreptitiously elbow the other and make a minute gesture at me. The other woman rolled her eyes, then returned my look. I looked down, reddening. I surmised I had been rude and turned my eyes away. I stood on the outskirts of the group, and joined in the applause when the song ended. The fellow with the harp was ready by then, and he coaxed them into a gentler tune, one with the steady rhythm of oars as its beat. The women sat on the edge of the table, back to back, their long black hair mingling as they sang. Folk sat down for that one, and some few moved to tables against the wall for quiet talk. I watched the man's fingers on the strings of the harp, marveling at the swiftness of his fingers. In a moment, a red-cheeked boy was at my elbow, asking what I would have. Just a mug of ale, I told him, and swiftly he was back with it, and the handful of coppers that were the remains of my silver piece. I found a table not too far from the minstrels, and rather hoped someone would be curious enough to join me. But other than a few glances from obviously regular customers, no one seemed much interested in a stranger. The minstrels ended their song and began talking amongst themselves. A glance from the older of the two women made me realize I was staring again. I put my eyes on the table. Halfway down the mug I realized I was no longer accustomed to ale, especially not on an empty stomach. I waved the boy back to my table and asked for a plate of dinner. He brought me a fresh cut of meat from the spit with a serving of stewed root vegetables and broth spilled over it. That and a refilling of my mug took away most of my copper pieces. When I raised my eyebrows over the prices, the boy looked surprised.
"It's half of what they charged you at the yardarm knot, sir,"
he told me indignantly.
"And the meat is good mutton, not someone's randy old goat come to a bad end."
I tried to smooth things over, saying, "Well, I suppose a silver bit just doesn't buy what it used to."
"Perhaps not, but it's scarcely my fault,"
he observed cheekily, and went back to his kitchens. Well, there's a silver bit gone faster than I expected. I chided myself.
"Now that's a tune we all know," observed the harper.
He was still sitting with his back to his own table, apparently watching me as his two partners discussed some problem they were having with a pipe. I nodded at him with a smile, and then spoke aloud when I noticed that his eyes were hazed over grey. "I've been away from the river road for a while, a long while actually, about 2 years. The last time I was through here, inns and food were less expensive."
"Well, I'd wager you could say that about anywhere in the six duchies, at least the coastal ones.
The saying now is that we get new taxes more often than we get a new moon.
He glanced about us, as if he could see, and I guessed he had not been blind long.
And the other new saying is that half the taxes go to feed the farrowmen who collect them.
Josh?
One of his partners rebuked him, and he turned to her with a smile.
You can't tell me there are any about just now, honey. I've a nose that could smell a farrowman at 100 paces.
And can you smell who you were talking to, then? She asked him wryly.
Honey was the older of the two women, perhaps my age.
A lad. A bit down on his luck, I'd say. And therefore not some fat farrowman come to collect taxes. Besides, I knew he couldn't be one of Bright's collectors the moment he started snivelling over the price of dinner. When have you known one of them to pay for anything at an inn or tavern?
I frowned to myself at that. When Shrewd had been on the throne, nothing was taken by his soldiers or tax collectors without some recompense offered. Evidently, it was a nicety Lord Bright did not observe, at least in Buck. But it did not recall me to my own manners. May I offer to refill your mug, Harper Josh? And those of your companions as well.
What's this?
Asked the old man, between a smile and a raised eyebrow.
You growl about spending coin to fill your belly, but you'd put it down willingly to fill mugs for us?
Shame to the lord that takes a minstrel's songs and leaves their throat dry from the singing of it. I replied with a smile. The women exchanged glances behind Josh's back, and Honey asked me with gentle mockery,
And when were you last a lord, young fellow?
'Tis but a saying, I said after a moment, awkwardly. But I wouldn't grudge the coin for the songs I've heard, especially if you've a bit of news to go with it. I'm headed up the river road. Have you, perchance, just come down?
No, we're headed up that way ourselves,
put in the younger woman brightly. She was perhaps 14, with startlingly blue eyes. I saw the other woman make a hushing motion at her. She introduced them.
As you've heard, good sir, this is Harper Josh, and I am Honey. My cousin is Piper, and you are?
Two blunders in one short conversation. One, to speak as if I still resided at Buck Keep, and these were visiting minstrels, and the other, to have no name planned out. I searched my mind for a name, and then, after a bit too much of a pause, blurted out, Cobb. And then wondered, with a shiver, why I had taken to myself the name of a man I'd known and killed.
Well, Cobb?
And Honey paused before saying the name, just as I had. We might have a bit of news for you, and we'd welcome a mug of anything, whether you're lately a lord or not. Just who are you hoping we won't have seen on the road looking for you?
Beg pardon?
I asked quietly, and then lifted my own empty mug to signal the kitchen boy.
He's a runaway prentice, father.
Honey told her father with great certainty.
He carries a scribe's case, strapped to his bundle, but his hair's grown out, and there's not even a dot of ink on his fingers.
She laughed at the chagrin on my face, little guessing the cause.
Oh, come. Cobb?
I'm a minstrel. When we aren't singing, we're witnessing anything we can to find a deed to base a song on. You can't expect us not to notice things. I'm not a runaway apprentice, I said quietly, but had no ready lie to follow the statement. How Chade would have rapped my knuckles over this blundering.
We don't care if you are, lad.
Josh comforted me.
In any case, we haven't heard any cry of angry scribers looking for lost apprentices. These days most would be happy if their bound lads ran away, one less mouth to feed in hard times.
And a scriber's boy scarcely gets a broken nose or a scarred face like that from a patient master.
Piper observed sympathetically.
So small blame to you if you did run away.
The kitchen boy came at last, and they were merciful to my flat purse, ordering no more than mugs of beer for themselves. First Josh, and then the women came to share my table.
The kitchen boy must have thought better of me for treating the minstrels well, for when he brought their mugs he refilled mine as well, and did not charge me for it. Still, it broke another silver bit to coppers to pay for their drinks. I tried to be philosophical about it, and reminded myself to leave a copper bit for the boy when I left. So then, I began when the boy had left. What news from downriver, then? And have not you just come from there yourself? Honey asked tartly. No, my lady. In truth, I had come cross-country from visiting some shepherd friends. I extemporized. Honey's manner was beginning to wear on me.
My lady,
she said softly to Piper and rolled her eyes. Piper giggled. Josh ignored them.
Downriver is much the same as up these days, only more so, he told me. Hard times, and harder to come for those who farm. The food grain went to pay the taxes, so the seed grain went to feed the children. So only what was left went into the fields, and no man grows more by planting less. Same is true for the flocks and herds, and no sign that the taxes will be less this harvest. And even a goose girl that can't cipher her own age knows that less take away more leaves naught but hunger on the table. It's worse along the salt water. If a person goes out fishing, who knows what will happen to home before he returns? A farmer plants a field, knowing it won't yield enough both for taxes and family, and that there will be less than half of it left standing if the red ships come to pay a call. There's been a clever song made about a farmer who tells the tax collector that the red ships have already done his job for him.
Save that clever minstrels don't sing it, Honey reminded him tartly.
Red ships raid Buck's Coast as well, then, I said quietly.
Josh gave a snort of bitter laughter.
Buck, Bairns, Ripon, or Shokes, I doubt the red ships care where one duchy ends and another begins. If the sea brushes up against it, they'll raid there.
And our ships? I asked softly.
The ones that have been taken away from us by the raiders are doing very well. Those left defending us, well, they are as successful as gnats at bothering cattle.
Does no one stand firm for Buck these days?
I asked, and heard the despair in my own voice.
The lady of Buckkeep does, not only firm but loud. There's some as say all she does is cry out and scold, but others know that she doesn't call on them to do what she hasn't already done herself.
Harper Josh spoke as if he knew this at first hand. I was mystified, but did not wish to appear too ignorant.
Such as?
Everything she can. She wears no jewellery at all any more. It's all been sold and put toward paying patrol ships. She sold off her own ancestral lands and put the money to paying mercenaries to man the towers. It's said she sold the necklace given her by Prince Chivalry, his grandmother's rubies, to King Regal himself, to buy grain and timber for Buck villages that wanted to rebuild.
Patience,
I whispered. I had seen those rubies once. Long ago, when we had first been getting to know one another. She had deemed them too precious even to wear, but she had shown them to me and told me, some day, my bride might wear them.
Long ago.
I turned my head aside and struggled to control my face.